Welcome to the Agile Revolution. This is Craig. We're at YAO 2015 in Sydney right now. And it's great to be sitting here with Aino Corrie. How are you doing, Aino?
I'm doing very well, thank you, Craig.
You're a return visitor to the Revolution. So we interviewed you a few years ago when you were at the conference. You come out here. You've been here for the last few years, I think, for the conference, haven't you?
Yes, I've been here every year since 2008.
So there you go. So you're a repeat. We don't often do repeat visitors, Aino. So there you go. You're in that privileged group of few.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Craig.
So what does bring you out? So you're part of the conference organising committee?
I am, yes. I work together with you, Craig, as you remember, and with Dave and all the others. And
I had forgotten.
Yeah, not as much. It's been a long week. So what I do is that I invite the speakers together with you and Dave, and we put together the programme, the schedule for the three conferences in Melbourne, Brisbane and Sydney. And then basically at the conference, I introduce the speakers in the morning and whoever needs to be introduced. And then if a speaker is sick or cancels, I step in to give a talk.
Which you did this year. And we do want to follow up on that because it was an awesome talk you gave in Melbourne. So for those who don't know you, you had your opening slide up in your talk in Melbourne and you had a wonderful way of describing what you do.
Thank you.
Tell us what that is.
Yeah, so I had basically I'm doing three different things. And I described it as I put speakers on stage, mm-hmm. which I just explained.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I make developers communicate.
Mm-hmm.
So I facilitate retrospectives and other meetings. And that's what I talked about in the earlier Agile Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing I do right now is that I mess with the heads of students.
Right. What does that mean?
Yeah, that was actually...
You brainwash them or something? Or?
I do actually brainwash them. So the interesting thing to me about teaching students is to figure out what's in their heads before I start putting some other knowledge in there. And that was basically what my talk in Melbourne was about. It was about how we learn. So at the talk in Melbourne, I presented some actually pretty old research about how the brain works and how we learn. And I acknowledge that there's newer research, but this is what works for me when I'm teaching. So what I'm doing is that I'm trying to figure out what kind of skill set do I want the students to have afterwards. Instead of just going through the curriculum and read a book and see what content do I have, I try to see what is it that I want them to get out of this. In what way do I want to change their brains, to mess with their brains? And then I do my best to try to figure out what's in their brains already, because sometimes they have some bad patterns, some misconceptions about things, and I need to figure out what they are and I need to help them break them down so that they can learn it in the right way. And what I do there, of course, is that I give them questionnaires before, I give them tests, I can look at the assignments, I do all kinds of activities with the students while I'm teaching them to figure out how they react to a problem, how would they solve that, and then look at the solution and see, okay, so you solve it like this, which might have been a good way in other places, but right now we have to learn about this way of doing it. And another thing I do is that I try to figure out what's in there that works in their head already. So instead of just starting my lecture, starting my teaching, I ask them what they know already, what are their prerequisites. Sometimes I can look at what courses they already had, if it's at the university, but if it's in industry, I might not be able to check that out. And then I try to build on that by relating to the knowledge they already have. And the third thing that I do is that I try to relate it to their real life. And so if you've studied computer science at university 20 years ago, like I did, a lot of the examples in the lectures were about beer drinking or cars or football or something like that.
I obviously went to the wrong university, but okay, yeah.
we had a lot of good stuff in Denmark. And I think it's very well with these examples, but I think that maybe they're not inclusive enough to the audience that I want to meet when I'm teaching. I would like to see if I can figure out how I can relate to all different kinds of students. And if you're talking about football and beer and cars, you would mostly be talking to the male audience.
The jocks.
The jocks, yeah. So I try to find things that would be interesting for the majority of people and try to find different examples and then relate it to their real life. Because if I can relate it to their real life, if I put in an effort to figure out, maybe I talk to them in the breaks about what they're interested in, things like that, if they feel that I've actually put an effort into trying to figure out who they are, they, A, what I say can relate to what they have, and B, they appreciate that I respect them enough to put in some extra energy to figure out who they are.
So I must say, if you listen to the podcast and hearing noise in the background, we unfortunately seem to position ourselves right outside the door of a ladies' bathroom, so the little ear machines will probably be going off as we talk. that must be an awful lot of work. Like, you know, if you're profiling those students, I mean, questionnaires and things like that. But more importantly, I mean, the amount of effort's astounding. I mean, you know, sometimes most lectures I had felt like they just turned up and, you know, put a 20-year slide deck up. But more importantly, I would have thought actually analysing that data at the end to try and get some sort of sense of, because you can't structure a class for, I don't know how many people are in a class, but, you know, let's just say 50 different students, you know, you might have 50 different things. So I assume you're looking for trends or something to find that.
Yeah, it is trends, but, and people always often ask me this, isn't that a lot of work? But it's fairly easy to find trends if you talk to 3 or 4 different people of the different kinds of people in the room, and then you maybe see a trend, and then you focus on that trend, and you don't. Sometimes you have like a standard example, and then you can just put some other words into that example, and suddenly it becomes an example that relates to their world. Another thing I do is just in time teaching, which is something that when I talk to teachers about this, they're really afraid, because what I do is that I ask the students in an email every week. Let's say I have a lecture Monday. So, okay, let's take a real concrete example. I had a lecture every Monday about programming in Java at the university, and I had 150 students in that class. So I said to them, you can send me an email no later than Sunday afternoon with the things you found interesting from last week, things you'd like to learn more about, and things you're still struggling with. And then I got some answers in a Google Doc, and I looked at these answers Sunday evening, and then I changed the lecture Monday morning. Yeah. And when I tell that to people, they say, gosh, that must be so much work. How can you do it? How can you take in 150 students and change your lecture? Well, two things. A, there won't be 150 students answering this. It'll only be a fraction. Yeah. And B, when you taught the class before, and maybe you've examined the students, you actually already have a hunch what they're struggling with.
Well, and you know the content too, right? Like, it's not as if you're turning up and going, what's Java?
Exactly.
You've been there and done it before, so.
Yes. So as a teacher, you have to know a lot more than what you're saying to the students.
If you're teaching nuclear thermodynamics for the first, maybe it'll be harder to
Maybe it'll be
it.
Harder, yeah. But if it's a course that you've given twice before, then it's a lot easier because you know what they're struggling with.
Yeah.
And also the way that I teach now is, instead of having a lecture where I have slides enough for 3 hours of lecture, what I have is that I cut it off in small pieces, so I have maybe 15 minutes of lecture of a main point, and then I have an activity. That could be a clicker where they get some questions, and they should say, so what's the output of this program? Does it terminate or not? Things like that. And then they click on a little device they have. You can use the smartphones now. And then I get the answers. And in that way, at the lecture, I can see they voted anonymously, so they're not afraid of saying that they don't know the answer or they have the wrong answer. I can see, okay, 50% said the correct thing, 30% said the wrong thing, and 20% chose not to answer. If I get that kind of result at a lecture, I know I have to give another example, and then I can give another example. But if it's like 80% answering it correctly, I can say, okay, I can move on. There might be 20% still struggling, but they might get it later on.
So 15 minutes content, then you put in an exercise. That sounds like you've microserviced your lectures.
I have actually microserviced my lectures. Yeah, you're right, I have. It's like a divide and conquer for my lectures. Mm. So what I do with the lecture, I look at this week's learning goals. So I make the learning goals for the whole course, and then I divide the learning goals into micro learning goals, one for each week. And for the learning goals, I figure out what are the main points here that they need to know. And then the assignments that the students get over the week are assignments that should train them in the skill set that I want them to have. And the skill set can be either a practical skill set where they have to program something, but it could also be a more analytical skill set where I want them to look at some code and see what comes out of it, or I want them to describe a content related to another. Yeah. I mean, describe a concept and relate it to another concept, something like that. So, and then I take the lectures and I divide it into the different main points that I want to give them. So I'm not going through the whole curriculum. They have to actually read most of the content themselves. What I do at my lectures is that I pinpoint things that I know from previous years or from my just-in-time questions they want to hear more about, and then I have some examples that I can use. And then, of course, sometimes I have to think on my feet and come up with a new example.
So what you're saying is you do have to think about what, well, there's an assumption that they've read the pre-reading, which I guess
they never do.
But I guess they're going to fall behind pretty quickly if they don't keep up with that.
Yeah. So another thing that I've noticed by teaching in that way is that if you get up there every week and you go through the whole curriculum, most people will not read before the lecture because they know you go through it. If, on the other hand, that they have learned that you're not going through the whole curriculum, plus they have activities where they're discussing with their neighbor or they're answering on the clicker questions, they get accustomed to the fact that if they have not prepared a bit, at least looked at the assignments or read some of it, then they don't get as much out of it as they did before. And that's why sometimes, I remember the first time I did it for a third year software architecture class, some people were really fighting against it. There were three people really fighting against it in the beginning because they hated that way of being taught. They wanted to just sit on the back row with their computer and have me go through the whole curriculum. So I gave them the slides from the previous year so they could go through them if they wanted to, but then I said, well, we're going to teach this way. And actually, after the course, two out of the three said that they really liked it and they felt they had gotten so much more out of it. One of them said he still hated it, but you can't please everybody.
I want to explore the agile angle of this in a moment, but the one question I do, this is a curiosity thing. Are you seeing a change now in universities? There seems to be a lot more online, people doing things distributed or fax, not even turning up to lectures because, you know, so much of this stuff is online. Is that something you're seeing a trend of in the classes you teach?
Not really. Five years ago, I started recording some videos of me solving some of the exercises because we have some programming exercises at the year one programming class, and that some people were really struggling with it because they had not chosen computer science, they'd chosen physics or chemistry or biology, so they didn't know anything about programming and they were really struggling. And my problem was I noticed that in the lecture I wanted to give them an example, so in my editor I went through like solving one of the programming exercises, but the problem was that the people who were already programming were really bored, and the people who didn't have a clue, it was too fast for them. And then there was a minority of people who really enjoyed that. So what I did was that I cut that out of the lecture, and then I made a video of not of my face, but just a screen recording when I went through it, and then I cut it up in different pieces so that they could have like the first part, the second part, so and so.
So you microserviced your videos, which is telling me, aren't you?
Sorry?
You microserviced your videos.
I microserviced my videos as well, because...
So breaking things down into smaller chunks, we've never heard of that before.
It's a trend right now. So what I noticed is that a lot of people actually looked at these videos. We could see in the statistics that they looked at these videos, and because they were only 2 or 3 minutes each, they actually, it looks as if they saw the whole video. And the feedback I got from the students was that they really, really enjoyed it, because the ones who knew how to program, they didn't need to watch them. But the ones who were struggling, they could watch it again and again, and they could do it on their own, with me talking or looking at the screen or doing whatever. But they still showed up for the lectures. That's a point I wanted to make. That even though they had that, they still showed up. But that was also, of course... There's something different going on in a lecture, I think, especially if there are activities. If it was just the lecture, then there's no reason to come if there's on video, right? But if there's activity and you get to click and you get to think and you get to discuss with your neighbor, then there's actually a reason to get there. We did record all the lectures as well, and they're probably out there if anybody wants to see them. But not as many people watched them, and of course they did not go through 3 hours of lecture because some of it was activities, and it's not that interesting to look at other people discussing with each other. So,
interesting. So your talk was all about, I guess, learning how to learn.
Yeah.
Really. And you mentioned some of the science and things like that. What sort of lessons do you think we can take away? I mean, you work with agile teams and retrospectives. What sort of things do you apply back in your teams, in your other job of helping teams collaborate?
Yeah, so one thing that I really learned from my from studying how people learn, how the brains work with learning, is to respect and acknowledge that other people take in information in different paces. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're stupid. It just means that they take in information in a different pace than yourself or in a different way than yourself. So when you're facilitating a retrospective, for instance, it is really, really important then when people have to think about something that they get some time to think of it before they have to react to it. So that those who need to reflect a bit before they start talking actually get time for that. Because otherwise, if you say, now you all go up to the board and you write down something that you think could be interesting, then some people will be struggling because they actually needed to be quiet and sit still before you ask them to do something about it. So that's something about what I mentioned about the active and the reflective preferences, that the reflective preferences wants to be alone and have some time on their own before they are asked to communicate about it or do something, while the active people need to do something. So that's why when you have an activity, make sure that people have a time to think and a time to communicate so that you cater for both.
Mm.
So I do take something like that. And also the thing about the constructivism, that whenever you tell people something, if it's not something that can be related to something they already have in their brain, it's very difficult for them to remember. They have to have it repeat again and again for it to stick in their brains if it's not related to something else. So whenever you discuss something at a retrospective or at a meeting, it can be a good idea to ask people, so what are you already doing now? Mm-hmm. And what is working, what is not working for you, instead of just having somebody say, well, we should definitely do pair programming.
Mm.
So instead of somebody saying, being allowed to just go on and on about that, you should probably stop this person and try to ask the audience, so what are you doing now, what's working for you, what's not working for you? And then they can think of things that are working for them and not working for them. And then, because they are aware and focused on that, they can start taking in the information about the new things.
And there's also, and we joked before about microservicing the information, but is there something in the science that says that in the example of a retrospective or even in a lecture that you have to put that in the small bits? Because I can imagine if you throw a deluge of information at people, there's all sorts of studies that say that people can only listen for about 8 minutes, and that's about as long as we've been on this podcast right now, but before they kind of start switching off and thinking about other things. Does the science show us that in order to hardwire that brain thing, that you can only throw so much, make sure the synapse fires and then go and do something else?
Yeah, I talked about the SOAR conceptual model of the brain in my presentation, where you have the working memory and the long-term memory. And the working memory is the part of the brain.
There's a great picture of her nose, by the way, in that diagram. Yeah, it has to be seen to be believed.
Yeah, it was my creative abilities that
were... A circle with a triangle on it, in case you don't know.
I had to put a little arrow saying this is a nose. So the working memory is the part of the brain that takes in new information, and it's a part of the brain that processes this information. But it's also the part of the brain that decodes the information in the long-term memory and use that in the processing, and then you can encode it back into your long-term memory. And the interesting thing is that you've probably all heard that you can only think about 7 plus minus 2 things at a time, and there's some research showing that you can actually triple that, so you can think about 21 things. I'm not sure about that, but the newest research shows that it's actually only 4 things.
Oh God.
Yes, it's getting worse.
So I'm trying to remember where I parked my car today.
Exactly.
Talking to you, and what I'm going to have to do. I'm screwed.
You're screwed. Yeah, but the good thing is that if you can attach where you park your car to something that's already in your brain, like is it probably close to where you parked it yesterday, or is it close to something that you thought about when you went past, you probably already put it somewhere in long-term memory, so you don't have to think about it.
I just parked it near the door, so there.
There you go.
I'll just run straight into it.
That's a good pattern. So that means that when you give people information, you have to think about that. You have to think about they can probably only take in a few concepts at a time, and then they need time to process it. Mm. And processing, that's the part where people are different, that some people need to reflect for processing to put it in the long-term memory, and some people need to discuss and be active with the information in order to put it in. And that's called chunking, and that's what I do at my lectures as well. I try to chunk the information so that every time they've been given a chunk of information, like some new concepts or something like that, they have time to either communicate and think.
Mm. And I guess when you're saying about the exercises where you get them to think about, obviously that's that doing it, but when you were saying that, there's a large number who don't answer, but perhaps they're the ones who are sitting there trying to get their head through it, right? So it's not a bad thing that they haven't necessarily answered, because they could be learning in that way.
Unless
they're sitting there on their phone.
That can happen as well. But what I've seen from I did a lot of research on teaching at universities and learning at universities. So I went to a lot of lectures, and I was always sitting in the back of the room, and then I could see what the students were actually doing with their iPads and their computers. And out of computer science, they would all say, we need to have the computers open because we need to take notes, or we need to look at the slides or something like that. But I know better. I mean, they know that I'm there in the back of the room, but after around 5 minutes, they forgot all about me. And then they were doing Facebook, and they were doing games, and they were looking at videos, and they were showing...
You're going to say porn, then, weren't
you? Yeah, I didn't want to say porn. They were kittens.
Yeah, kitten videos, yeah. Absolutely. So that 7 plus or minus 2 thing is interesting now. I mean, down to 4. Do you think some of that translates into, if we think about agile teams and the like, things like breaking things down, stories, even the amount of things we can do. If we're getting worse, multitasking is a huge problem.
Multitasking is a huge misunderstanding. Mm. It's a huge misunderstanding. We're discussing that in university teaching right now, because all the young people, the students, they believe that they can multitask because they do that when they do their homework, and all research shows it's wrong. It's miserably wrong. You can multitask, but it only means that you're doing two things like 40% instead of one thing 100%. And I'm worried about this, because what we need in computer science and in research as well as in industry is people who can focus and really, really work on a problem so that you can find a good solution. And the systems are not getting less complicated, they're getting more complicated. I know microservices will make them less complicated, but we're still talking about a huge amount of microservices, and we're talking about a huge amount of communication with the cloud and other systems, and it's not getting less complicated, it's getting more complicated.
And the amount of things that an average software developer, for example, has to keep in their head now. I mean, it used to be, I'm a Microsoft developer, I'll go and learn, C# and version 5, and I'll be a happy man, and maybe the SQL Server, and that's it. But now the stack is so wide, and it's not just even in that technology.
No, we expect so much more from them, but also in the agile with the cross-functional teams, we expect them to do other things as well. Mm. We still appreciate the I people, the people who are experts, but we want some more T-shirt people as well. And I think it can be harmful also. I'm a bit worried about that. And so when I'm teaching, I'm telling the students, it's okay if you want to sit with your computers, but if you do, you need to sit in the back row. Mm. Because I'm not irritated with you sitting with your computers, but everybody else behind you, if there is somebody sitting in front of you with a computer, you can't help looking at it, especially not if it's Facebook or moving pictures or something flashy or something like that. And then they'll complain and they'll say, I'm doing my notes and things like that. I don't care. When you have a screen that size in front of you, other people will be disturbed by it. So you sit in the back row. So I'm not saying they can't do it. I'm just saying it's better not to. And when there are activities, I notice that they actually shut down their computers because they have to communicate, they have to do something together, and that the computers are shot most of the times in more active lectures. Mm. That's my experience.
So, all this research and things you found out about how we can learn how to learn, what are some tips that people can take away if they're, people obviously listening to this podcast because they want to learn something, maybe not. maybe it's listening because they stumble across on iTunes. But, people who normally listen to this podcast are people who are eager to learn more. So, what are some things that you sort of picked up from all that? What are some of the tips you'd pass on so that we can become better learners or train our brain to be better at learning?
Yeah. So what has worked for me is one of the things that worked for me is that I took this Kepler test about learning preferences, where you have the global and the sequential, and the active and the reflective, and there are other continuums as well. And that has taught me that I have a very global preference for learning. That means that sometimes when
I... Does that mean you have to come to Australia to come to a conference to learn
something?
Exactly.
I'm very global in that way. It means that I need to see the big picture in order to understand the small snippets, the details of whatever it is that I'm going to learn. So I acknowledge in myself now that when there is a new subject I need to understand, or new concepts I need to understand, I need to figure out what is the big picture, what are the relations between the subsystems in this, and even what are the relations to the big subsystems I have in my own brain so that I can relate it to that. And once I have that in place, I can start digging down into the details. Because if I start digging down into the details, I lose the information. I lose my motivation, and I lose the information. And in the beginning, when I was teaching, I did as every other teacher does, I think, in the beginning. They go back to how did I learn this, and then they try to explain it in the same way, because they, well, this is the way that I had to learn it, so apparently this is the way you learn this. And then I would always start my courses with a very global presentation of the course, and then some people would be very frustrated because they needed the nitty-gritty details and they were just waiting for them because they were sequential learners and they needed that. So I think one good thing is to try to figure out what kind of learner am I, what preference do I have? And then also acknowledge the thing about the chunking, that you can't take in all that information at the same time. You have to accept that whenever you've taken in some new concept or some new theory, you have to work with it in one way or the other. And a third thing that I think is very important when you're learning is don't plug all night. It's very important to sleep. That is when the brain drills the patterns down. If you don't sleep, you don't learn.
So I guess my last question, I just want to come back to what you're saying about how you, yeah, how you found your global, and how do you find that information out? How do you know what your style is? Because I'm sure, for example, I have this theory that this is the way I learn, and I'm sure it's completely wrong. I'm someone who I think I've found that taking notes, that's how I if I write it down, that
yeah,
triggers that.
Some people are like that, yeah.
Memory for me. I'm not entirely sure that's entirely correct. How do I know? How do I go and find out what type of learner I am?
Well, there are different tests out there that you can take online, but also I think you should try and reflect upon things that you've learned. Not just when it comes to computer science, but how did you learn to ski? How did your parents teach you to cycle? How did you learn a new language? How did you learn every skill set? How did I go about, and when did I have these flashes of understanding? I bet a lot of us can remember flashes of understanding. It could be physical understanding, where you learn to do something new, or it can be more theoretical understanding. I try to look at that. So, well, reflect upon how you learn and try to find some tests online.
Those tests are reasonably accurate, I assume, like because of the way they're designed?
Well, I don't know if they're reasonably accurate, but they give you a hint.
Yeah, I guess so. And, part of learning is learning how to learn, I guess, isn't it?
So. Yeah, and the interesting thing about, for instance, what I talked about before with the global and the sequential and the active and the reflective is that science shows, that studies show that after 5 or 10 years at the university, everybody converges to the middle, so that they're not necessarily global or a sequential learner, but they're actually a little bit of both, which didn't happen to me. I'm still very global, so I can't get rid of that trait, apparently.
So the final thing, we were here at Yale, and there's lots of really interesting things you've been learning. What's some stuff you picked up that's going around the place, and things that have tweaked your interest?
Interesting question. Yeah, so I think that the things that I'm most interested in right now is the thing about the culture. So I was very intrigued by Dan North's presentation. I think I saw the one in Melbourne where he talked about these dedicated teams in Agile. And what I like is to hear something which surprises me, and that makes me very motivated and inspired. And what surprised me was that he said that actually this about the dedicated teams might be false. It might be so that you can have a lot of people, and if they have the same values, if they have the same focus, they can have the same goal. If you know that it's the same kind of people, you can actually put them together in a much more non-deterministic way and make them work together for a shorter period of time. It doesn't have to be like the forming, norming, storming, performing. It can be faster. So that is one thing that really piqued my interest. And also you talk about the 40 Agile methods in 40 minutes make me think about, when you talk about programming languages, there's been this movement about polyglot programming, where you take the programming language for the thing that you're doing right now. It's okay to have more than one language, because sometimes you have to do something which has to be fast, or something resilient, or something else. Of course, you want everything all the time, but you can't. And I think maybe that watching your presentation about the Agile, 40 Agile methods, make me think that maybe we should be, as you said, more pragmatic about what process we choose, and maybe we could even make every team choose their own process, and maybe we can change the process depending on what kind of system that we have to build and the resources we have at hand.
Polyglot Agile.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you think about that, and we're lucky to have Dave Thomas at the conference, Pragmatic Dave Thomas. one of the signatories, and his message is, you know, we have to stop, you know, talking about agile and be more focused on agility, which you know, is really at the heart of what they wrote about.
Yeah, that's true.
15 odd years ago, which is awesome.
Yeah, I like that. Agile is dead. Long live agility. I like that way of thinking about it.
Absolutely. Well, I know it's been awesome talking to you. I'm going to sit here for another hour talking to you about stuff because so much to want to grab out of that head and learn about. And check out the talk that it'll be online. The slides on her Learning to Learn talk. There's some interesting things in there. If you want to know more about you and all the stuff that you're up to, where can they find you online?
Well, I've got a Twitter account. That's APAIPI. And today I tweeted a picture about a urinal here at Yao, so it's a very interesting Twitter account to follow.
Excellent. I don't want to ask how you got a picture of a urinal, but there you go.
I didn't know it was a urinal. It was something weird outside, and I took a picture and asked what it was. And
okay, now we have context. That was you've just been walking into men's rooms for no apparent reason.
No.
Excellent. And also awesome job on putting together the conference again. So
likewise.
So well done. And I know certainly you've had a hand in a lot of other big conferences around the world, so... thank you for that as well.
Yeah.
So we have a little tradition on the Agile Revolution. When we finish, we say the words "Viva la Revolution." So you want to join me in that?
Yes, of course.
All right. So thanks everybody for listening, and
Viva la Revolution.